PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
King of the Road. This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're taking today's show on the road. We're driving up U.S. Route 1 and the Merritt Parkway, maybe Interstate 95, we don't even know for sure, from New York up into Connecticut, on my way to see Mark Twain's house in Hartford. Along the way, we'll listen to some stories told by some great cultural road warriors like Willie Nelson.
On the road again.
And Ralph Stanley, the bluegrass singer you know from the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
We didn't have time, you know, to really stop and eat a meal. We just had to grab us a can of ale and a sausage or whatever we could get.
And we'll hear some people trek through the California desert like pilgrims to see a mountain built by hand.
It looks like a big ice cream cone, really, but he takes mud and he packs it all in there and he paints it.
My traveling companion today, and actually the driver of this minivan that we're traveling in, is Andy Borowitz. And Andy, in addition to being, I hope, a skillful driver, has a new book out called Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison. Andy Borowitz is also a hugely successful television and film producer and writes for The New Yorker magazine. But today, I am depending on him not only for his good company, but to, as I say, drive us safely 100 miles from here to Mark Twain's house in Hartford. Are you up to it?
Yes, I'm really concentrating on the road. If I say nothing funny, I hope you'll excuse me, but it's really your life I'm really thinking about today.
When I was 17 years old, after I graduated from high school, I bought a school bus with some friends, and we spent the entire summer just driving aimlessly through the Southwest and into Mexico and through Mexico, which, as the parent of teenagers now, I find, in retrospect, incredibly irresponsible to have let me done that. But here we are, as 40-something-year-olds, reenacting that great road myth. Here, right here where we are, it's not quite an easy rider thing. Here's the Rye Ridge Shopping Center and a food emporium and a
D'Agostino.
Mobile station. But we're getting to the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm already feeling it. We're sort of on the outer edge of something. I'm not sure what. I think the outer edge of Rybrook.
Do you know where we're going, by
yeah,
the way?
Yeah, okay. I do. I'm taking you gradually to the Merritt. Well, it seems like a little police activity up ahead.
How are you?
Good.
Were you driving past here last Friday around 1 p.m. when the murder occurred?
No.
Thank you.
That's when it'll happen. Pretty much on a regular basis.
That was an actual police officer who just stopped us. Well, stopped you, Andy, and asked if you were driving past here when the murder occurred.
Well, let me first of all...
Now, you claim to know all the streets pretty well around here.
Let me first of all give you some insight into one of my goals for this road trip is I'm actually looking for the real killers. I just want to say that.
Just the real killers in general, not OJ's wife.
No,
just the real killer.
Absolutely. And I was nowhere near this place last Friday when the murder occurred. People keep on dogging me about that. And that guy, I could just tell.
He was friendly about it, though.
Well, yeah. They're always friendly. But I could just tell there was that little edge. Like, I just have a feeling that pig's going to be on my trail all day today. I just have a feeling. We may have to do a couple little detours outside of West Hartford to shake him. I just have a feeling. Quite frankly, you're my hostage now.
Well, we've come to a stop sign, which is nicely appropriate. It gives me an opportunity to play for you today's Design for the Real World segment. What we're going to hear now is the graphic designer and critic Stephen Heller talking about the one street sign that nobody can ignore.
Everybody knows what a stop sign is. That's what's great about a stop sign. You know what it means without having to be literate in the language that may be impressed upon it. All you have to do is see it. It's easy to overlook blue because the sky is blue. It's easy to overlook green because The grass is green, but red. You stop for red. You stop for red lipstick. It's the symbolic force of that color that makes it viable. The eight-sidedness, I think, has to do with how it sits in the landscape. It breaks up the visual space. It isn't as common on the street as a circle or a triangle or a square or a rectangle. The stop sign is used in other contexts. It's not simply a traffic sign. You can put as much eye-catching imagery as you want on a billboard or a website or in a magazine. But once that stop sign is placed on a page, you stop. You instinctively stop. There's no choice in the matter. Stop doesn't give you choice.
Stephen Heller is the author of more than 80 books on design. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360's Roadshow. My guest and my driver is Andy Borowitz. Andy and I are driving up the Merritt Parkway from the New York suburbs of New York City toward Hartford, Connecticut. The pilgrimage we're making today, since we're both writers and Andy's a humorist and I try to write novels, is to Mark Twain's house, one of Mark Twain's house. I guess the house where he wrote his most famous works.
It's supposed to be just magnificent. It's sort of aesthetic period mansion.
Is he the guy in American Letters who you look up to most, or one of them?
I really do. It's interesting how Mark Twain has lasted in a way that so much humor is a really has such a poor shelf life. The references are dated so quickly, and
if you read his contemporaries, they're just only interesting as artifacts.
Right. Well, in a way, I think a lot of what, when I write something very topical or when my contemporaries do, I think it's almost we're providing more of a diary of the period than we really are anything lasting. Because I think what Twain had, he had a couple things going for him besides genius. One thing is his language was so simple. I mean, he really was not trading on a lot of the period slang except in service of character. And also just a brilliant narrative. And I think narrative rules. I mean, narrative will always survive longer than the funny, hilariously crafted line about something that happened the day after yesterday. Which I guess is today.
You got your big break, or your breaks, as a writer, as an important Hollywood writer, pretty early in life after college. How did that happen?
Well, I was president of the Lampoon at Harvard. I had to speak at an event. We were hosting a Hollywood producer named Bud Yorkin, who was also a director, and we were showing one of his films. And I had to give an introduction to him. And I did sort of 5 minutes of stand-up. And afterwards, he just kind of in sort of Schwab drugstore style.
You got it, kid.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, come on out and work for me. And I think he had no idea exactly what I would do for him. And I didn't know, except that I knew that I wouldn't be going to law school, which sounded attractive to me. So I wound up, I think about 3 weeks after graduation, going right out to Hollywood. So it was quick.
How'd you get out to Hollywood?
I drove. I did. I drove with my friend John Bowman, who was from Milwaukee. I remember we had a very specific itinerary. We wanted to see where we could find the worst dinner theater in America.
You literally went to dinner theaters?
We did. Well, we were doing sort of a survey by reading the paper and looking at the ads. We wanted to find what the worst possible candidate would be. And we went all the way to El Paso, where we stumbled upon a dinner theater that was called, in this very sort of cosmopolitan, pretentious way, the Empire Club. And the Empire Club was run by a guy. He was the artistic director. And he wrote this really pissed off editorial about how sometimes he got the impression that El Paso didn't want theater. Because I guess it was very
poorly
attended.
Waiting for Guffman. It sounds like a Chris Guest movie.
Well, it was. Well, and he got out beforehand, and he started doing a couple jokes to sort of warm up the crowd. And the jokes sounded very, very familiar. And then I realized that I had read them out of like the local syndicated column in the local newspaper, which explained why they weren't getting any laughs, because I think the entire audience had also read them in the same column. Then he said, now I want you to enjoy tonight's show, which was, I think, a show called Take My Wife. It was a bedroom sex romp set in New York City. And, you know, the curtain goes up, and they're doing these jokes. And every joke is an extremely local New York City Manhattan joke. Again, dying. And then just as our attention was flagging, the artistic director jumps out on stage. We think, oh my God, what is he going to do? Is he going to shut down the theater? No, he was in character now. He was also playing a role in the show. So it was absolutely, you know what? It just shows, sometimes when you're on the road, don't stop at the first restaurant you see. Wait and wait for the really great one. And this was it. We waited until El Paso to see Dinner Theater, and our patience was rewarded.
See, having a sort of plan like that, a theory of we're going to see Dinner Theaters, I have a friend who always goes to secondhand bookstores, for instance, in cities, as her means of getting beyond the, you know, Applebee's, mm-hmm. McDonald's, you know, kind of national franchise veneer and sort of getting to the real stuff. It sounds like with that experience you very much got to a very singular and real little bit of Americana.
Well, what's fun about it when you go to something like dinner theater is you sort of wonder what was the road that the person took to get to that dinner theater. What was that guy before? Was he, you know, was he bounced from some other theater for drinking too much or something? It's sort of interesting. It reminds me of that first scene in the Billy Wilder film, Eights in the Hole, where you have Kirk Douglas is this sort of worn-out newspaper man. You see him behind the wheel of his car just sort of moseying along, and then you see this car is being towed. And, you know, it's him finally at the last stop of his career, which is trying to pull out one last miracle. And so it's America. When you get far out enough, you see all kinds of stuff like that, which is kind of cool.
When we first started talking about doing this show, as we were figuring out a kind of great summer vacation version of Studio 360, one of the pop culture touchstones that occurred immediately was, of course, Willie Nelson on the road again.
On the road again.
So, because we have this radio show, we got to talk to Willie Nelson. In fact, we talked to him on his bus after a show in Ruston, Louisiana, about his life on the road, which we're trying to get a taste of ourselves. Let's listen.
Oh, I remember picking cotton alongside the highway there in central Texas, and about 100 degree weather, and cars coming by on the highway, these big Cadillacs with the windows rolled up and the air conditioner going. And I knew then that there was better ways than the one I was going through then. So that's when I realized that I had to get out of the cotton patch and go get in the Cadillac.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road.
I enjoy waking up in a new world every morning, like, you know, the proverbial goose. We do a couple hundred days a year, but we're out here a pretty good percentage of the days. I was doing a movie, Honeysuckle Rose movie, and the producer and director was looking for some music, and they asked me to write something, and so I jotted a few things down, Well, actually, I wrote the whole thing, practically, just sort of off the top of my head. I asked them what they wanted the song to be about. I said, well, about being on the road. Yeah, they looked a little stunned because they thought there was going to be more to it than that. First of all, you're away from your family, and that's the hardest. That's what has broken up more bands than anything.
Love's the greatest healer.
Once you get by that obstacle, and you may have to get by that one two or three or four or five times, that's the first step in becoming a regular out here.
So leave me if you need to.
That was Willie Nelson on his tour bus in Louisiana. This is Kurt Anderson with Andy Borowitz on our tour bus of sorts on the Merritt Parkway heading northeast in Connecticut on our road trip version of Studio 360. Andy, Can you imagine being on the road 200 days a year, as Willie Nelson said he was?
Well, this is why I keep on turning down his offers to join his band, because, no, I couldn't. That's amazing to me. That's just amazing. I think you have to have sort of a restless spirit to enjoy that, which I don't really have. I do as a comedian, I do a certain number of dates a year, but rarely, I'm rarely gone 2 weeks in a row. I would find that hard.
Do you think this idea of the road and the road trip is peculiarly American? I mean, obviously there was the Canterbury Tales and Mary and Joseph and other road tales for as long as history has been written, but there does seem something Americans at whatever level, whether it's the family vacation or songs like Willie Nelson's, celebrating the idea of rolling along.
Well, I think some of it is just geographic fact and destiny. I mean, I think that I've done a lot of driving in England, for example, but in England, you know, if you really want to stay behind the wheel and not take many breaks, you could sort of do the whole country in a day. And I do think that in America, the idea of hitting the road always just suggests tremendous new possibilities, even though that turns out often to be an illusion. But I don't think that is true. For example, if you're driving around the Lake District in England, thinking, "Oh, that's finally where
I can reinvent myself now that I've left the Cotswolds.
Now that I'm on the A42, all bets are off."
Well, and there is in the wonderful Albert Brooks movie,
Lost in America.
Lost in America. That's
sort of what we're doing today, Kurt. So I must be a little reverent.
It's not quite a Winnebago, but it is. It's a bigger than normal car. But that, again, I mean, there was some real truth to that of, you know, this desk-bound middle-aged schlub, you know, starting to play Born to Be Wild as he...
Well, that was just such a great shot where they started tight on the wheel as it was going down the highway and then pulled back and revealed his Winnebago.
And now we're stuck in traffic again, so our Born to Be Wild moment hasn't quite arrived, but we've got plenty of time, plenty of miles to go.
We had one run-in with the cops, though, so that was
kind
of like a Dennis Hopper kind of thing.
Exactly. I'm glad I cut my hair. I had a haircut this week.
You hippie.
Let's pull over for a minute, and when we come back, we'll listen to a story about some highway pilgrims on the other side of the country on their way to see a man-made mountain. I'm Kurt Anderson with the writer and humorist and comedian Andy Borowitz on our way to the Mark Twain House in Hartford. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360's mobile unit. Today, I'm on the road with the humorist Andy Borowitz. And we are driving on the Merritt Parkway in Connecticut, driving through a beautiful tree-lined sort of essentially rural boulevard, but not moving as fast as we'd like to be on our road trip. We're barely making 20, so we are debating taking the next exit and swinging up to Hartford in a different way. The whole rationale for this trip is Mark Twain's house in Hartford, Connecticut, which we are both dying to see. As a child, when on these vast cross-country car trips we used to go on, although we went whenever we came near them to the you know, iconic places like Mount Rushmore. I don't ever remember the trips being so much about those iconic destinations as it was really about, you know, having these four kids and two parents, you know, cooped up in a tin box for 3 weeks. Are the trips you've gone on more about destinations or about the journey, the road traveled?
Well, when I was a kid, we went to no iconic destinations. That was never an issue. We went to places like Sandusky, Ohio.
Not even Niagara Falls? Or?
No, we didn't get up there. We went. Sandusky, Ohio had an amusement park, still does, called Cedar Point, which is sort of legendary for northeastern Ohio. But I remember car trips also being about car trouble. I remember that pretty vividly. We were driving once down to southern Ohio for something, and all of a sudden the car spun out of control and spun over to the shoulder of the road and into kind of a bed. It turned out the drive shaft of the car had fallen out. And do you know what the drive shaft of a car does?
It is the thing that actually turns the wheels.
Yeah, it's the thing that makes the car go in the direction you intended to go. That was the part that fell out of our car. So really, we could have been goners. I mean, it's kind of, as a dad now, I think it's must be such a frightening thing to suddenly lose control of your car.
Similarly, I remember on one of our great summer vacations, having just gone over the Continental Divide when the brakes on our station wagon simply failed.
Wow.
And of course, you're at the top of a mountain heading down, and my father, I guess, pulled us into a sort of dirt shoulder. But again, as an adult, looking back and imagining what might have happened as we were hurtling over the Rockies without brakes, it's a little sobering.
I think it's safe to say there would be no Studio 360 road trip show if either of us had perished in that way. And the audience is the real winner here.
And even though neither of us have spent much time in our lives on road trips to a destination that, like pilgrims, that's certainly what we're doing today, and it is certainly what a lot of people out in the middle of the desert of California do. It's what our next story that we're going to listen to is about. It's a place called Salvation Mountain. As a former Southern Californian, do you know Salvation Mountain?
I do not. What is that?
Well, you'll hear about it. It's the place that Palis Vaida explored out in the desert in California on our behalf.
I love the feel of the road through the steering wheel. It's good to get out of the city and chase the horizon. I needed a chance to clear my head and think about things, so I took a road trip. I'd heard about Salvation Mountain in the California desert town of Niland near the Salton Sea, and I'd read about the RV community behind the mountain called Slab City, a hobo camp of people with nowhere to go, living in broken-down caravans perched atop abandoned concrete slabs. Salvation Mountain is Slab City's monument to freedom, a hobo Statue of Liberty built entirely by one man named Leonard. He's 71 years old, and I'm told he greets everyone who visits his mountain. My friend and I left Los Angeles, driving east on the sunny Bono Memorial Freeway, through a valley of windmills, past Palm Springs and towards the Salton Sea. The sea is a study in failure. It was born by mistake when irrigation channels burst in 1905. It sparkles precariously in the harsh desert landscape. Its shores are littered with failed real estate developments. We stopped at Bombay Beach, a sandy shore town of shacks, trailers, and the occasional burned-out building. I went into the town bar called the Ski Lodge to ask about Salvation Mountain. A man referred to as Wacko described it to me.
It looks like a big ice cream cone, really, but he takes mud and he packs it all in there. We give him paint. People donate it to him, and he paints it.
We left Bombay Beach and headed for Niland and Salvation Mountain. You can't miss Salvation Mountain. It rises out of the desert in all its psychedelic glory, 3 stories high and over 100 feet long. The mountain looks like a birthday cake with a patchwork quilt of icing and streams of syrup, its adobe surface painted in every color imaginable. Instead of candles, there's a cross on top, made from a telephone pole. Leonard painted "God is love" on his mountain in huge letters visible from the road. There's a sign by the turnoff that says, "God never fails. Salvation Mountain. Repent. And for sale."
Hello, is anyone here?
There was no sign of Leonard, so we walked to the base of the mountain that rose out of a painted adobe ocean with a rowboat in it. A yellow staircase wound to the top, and we climbed past sculpted flowers, Bible verses, and a massive red heart that adorned the front of the mountain like a big sticker. I thought perhaps Leonard would be sitting on top, waiting for us.
Oh, here we are at the top.
This was why I came, to see the desert stretch for miles around me. I stood on top of Leonard's mountain, witness to an empty landscape, uncluttered and peaceful, decorated with this surprising riot of color beneath me. A carload of tourists pulled up, and for the first time, Leonard appeared.
Well, hi!
Hi!
Hello, how are you?
Hi, thank
you. Make yourself at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a visitor from Japan.
Japan!
Hello. Leonard draws people to him, a beacon for free spirits. He's tall and rail thin in jeans, old boots, and a cowboy hat that's as weathered as his face. Leonard's squinted eyes are a little unnerving. He served as a tank mechanic in the Korean War and worked shoveling snow and teaching guitar before landing in Nyland, where he lives in a painted bus with his cats.
I was going to stay 1 week and make a little 8-foot one 19 years ago, and I'm still here. You can see the two waterfalls in the blue paint. In the ocean, in the blue, in the boat, in the waves.
Leonard was 34 when he had his liberating experience. He began saying,
Jesus, I'm a sinner, please come into my heart.
Over and over, he built a hot air balloon with the words God is love on it. The balloon never flew, and Leonard pays homage to it at the base of his mountain, with adobe rooms that resemble the billowing balloon canopy, cool and cavernous, with fantastic trees inside for support.
And I had 900 bales of hay in it, more or less. And I made this tree with a wheelbarrow, with tractor tires and wet adobe, 8 truck tires and adobe, 14 car tires. And it's all full of adobe.
The mountain fell down once.
I didn't build it right. I used cement and too much sand. And I didn't know about adobe. So I had to start over again in 1990.
Leonard rebuilt it and included a mailbox for God at the bottom. I asked Leonard what he's trying to say with his mountain.
The world needs a love story now, about millions of little people helping me out because I don't know how to do anything. And I'm trying to put love to everybody in the whole world. Let's love our enemies better.
He plans to keep on building.
I'm really on cloud nine. I just plain think that the mountain is picking up a tremendous speed lately.
I walked down to the hobo camp of Slab City behind Leonard's mountain. An outdoor theater was there, with aisles made of car seats, amidst old buses and RVs with cactus gardens around them. A man there told me,
throughout history, there have always been those people that didn't fit in, but this is the last refuge right here.
Leonard wanted to sing us a song. As we went to get his guitar, I remarked that we were walking across water, his adobe ocean in the blue. He chuckled and told me that everyone has a little bit of Jesus in them. He sent us on our way with this song.
It's so easy to envy me for being part of Slab City. I'm privileged and honored to be a part.
For Studio 360, I'm Polly Sfida.
A family gave me a smile, so I think I'll linger here a while. Here in Slab City, California, USA.
You can see images of Salvation Mountain on our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, in the car, actually the minivan today, on the road with the writer Andy Borowitz. And we're heading up at a great clip now, 60 miles an hour, or whatever the speed limit is here is what we're going. As we were listening to that piece about this amazing sounding creation out in the desert in California. You mentioned you've been out in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I spent 15 years in Los Angeles. Talk about a place where you need to drive everywhere.
And the Salton Sea out there, that to me, that sort of desert area, and I've driven through it on the way from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, but never really spent time there. It's always seemed, you know, in its kind of Manson-esque associations, like a scary part of the world to me.
You know, the Salton Sea, I can honestly say I haven't really spent much time in, but when I was in film production and TV production, the Salton Sea was
always brought up as a place that you would shoot, you know, because it was sort of remote and it could double for a lot of things. It's sort of an interchangeable place. And I'm not sure where they shot the Planet of the Apes movies, especially the first one, but they got that sort of weird otherworldly quality of desert. I think maybe not far from the Salton Sea, if not there.
Hearing about that mountain, Salvation Mountain, reminded me of another sort of famous Southern California outsider art monument, the Watts Tower.
Uh-huh.
Watts. Is there something about a certain kind of Southern California sensibility that leads to that kind of thing?
You know, I think the one thing that sort of... I was actually in Los Angeles earlier this week, and I think it's impressive that people out there are trying to build things, because things mainly seem to get torn down out there. It just seems like such an impermanent landscape. So I really think somebody who's trying to build a monument to anything out there is really swimming against the tide. So maybe it's in the case of Leonard, you know, people say he's a little bit touched, but I think in a way everybody would have to be a little bit touched to even build a home that they expect to still be there 20 years from now.
Studio 360, the mobile version, the roadshow version, is now approaching New Haven, Connecticut, on our way to Hartford. We're going to turn inland shortly. And as we do, we're going to listen to our next story, which is about an artist named Mike Rogers. Mike Rogers wanted to create a glimpse of the whole darn expanse of America from one end to the other, and that's exactly what he did, as he explains, in a 23-minute movie.
When I say we, I mean my wife and kids. We moved to L.A. from New York, and I was interested in patriotism and what was going on with the flag waving and people's interests in the country, and I decided I would drive across the country, and I decided I wanted to make a movie about the country. I thought I would just do something as simple as putting a movie camera on the dashboard of my car and filming the road and not making any detours, just driving during the day, 12 hours a day, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. So I bought an old Super 8 millimeter camera that had an intervalometer, which allowed me to take a frame every 6 seconds. And I figured that crossing the country would result in about a half hour movie, and that would be about the amount of time you could expect people to sit in one place and watch something. I started at the Atlantic Ocean in Coney Island. I was hoping that I would get what I did get, which is a view of the road and some of the surrounding landscape.
New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
And Super 8 film doesn't really give the color that you see. And
West Virginia.
There are purples, and where there shouldn't be purples, and
Ohio,
and the sky is kind of washed out, and
Indiana, Illinois.
What surprised me is that although
Missouri,
the action on the road goes by very fast, especially cars coming in the opposite direction.
Kansas.
The landscapes along the side really didn't move that fast.
Oklahoma.
There are large stretches of the country that don't change very, very rapidly.
Texas.
Time sort of slows down as well.
New Mexico, Arizona, and California.
I think I've got them all right, in the right order. I ended at Santa Monica on the beach. We do these trips, many of us, you know, when we're young, and then the next time I ever saw the country was, like most people, from an airplane. And it just seemed interesting to me at this time, with people's feeling so strongly about the country, And yet probably so many of us are so distant from the country. Whatever comes out of it, maybe it's that thought that people should not only see our country, but see other countries, and they should see ours.
That's the artist Mike Rogers. His film Cross Country has been presented at art galleries in New York City, Santa Monica, and the United Arab Emirates, among other places. You can find out more about it and him at studio360.org. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm with the writer Andy Borowitz. We are on the road, talking about the road. I had a chance to watch this film last night. It is 23 minutes from sea to shining sea, and it doesn't seem that speeded up, given that he goes 3,000 miles in 23 minutes. And it's quite extraordinary. There's no music accompanying it, which seems like a perverse choice, that it's just this silent, fast thing. But, you know, like a lot of contemporary art, it kind of rewards a kind of patient gaze and comes across like some kind of, I don't know, pop art moving landscape. I mean, it's sort of in its plainness and its relative lack of variation, it's kind of beautiful. But just the stunt of it, that it is literally, you get to see the whole country in 23 minutes is
I've got to cool. Say, in listening to the piece, Kurt, I was struck by the similarity between what he was doing and the guy building the mountain, because it's a very strange thing to apply yourself to. Very peculiar. I mean, sort of impressive that you would stick with that.
Maybe again, it is some kind of slightly eccentric American obsession with that, you know, either the road trip. There's Johnny Appleseed, obviously, the Mr. Road Trip of the 19th century, or making a monument, like this guy in South Dakota who has been with his sons, and now his sons have taken over because I think he's dead, carving this giant mountain-sized sculpture of Crazy Horse.
I do know about that.
Which is, I mean, again, it's hard to imagine that happening in Norway or England.
It's true.
Well, we're in... Okay, here we are. Jeez. We haven't gone as far as we were supposed to, according to our schedule, Andy, but I know you'll do your best.
Lewis and Clark had a lot of hardships along the way, too, Kurt. So, I mean, I think it's okay. It's very American what's going on right now.
I hope the microphones picked up that sound. Of
that turbo, that acceleration.
Exactly. Among the things you've done and that you do is make, in various ways, films. Do you have favorite road movies?
I'm trying to think of my favorite road movies. Well, I've got to say, you touched on one of the all-time great ones, which was Lost in America by Albert Brooks. I mean, I think that's one of the funniest and truest ones. I'm trying to think what other ones have been really good. Clockwise with John Cleese. Did you ever see that?
I did not.
Clockwise is all about a guy who is a British headmaster who is determined to get to a headmaster's conference where he's going to give the keynote address. And his big thing is punctuality. He's just obsessed with punctuality. Michael Frayn wrote the screenplay, and it's all about all the bad things that can happen to you going from point A to point B.
I didn't know Michael Frayn wrote movies. He's a great novelist and playwright.
Yeah. Well, this is it's a great screenplay, and it has one of the all-time great lines, sort of great existential lines, which was he keeps on thinking he's going to get to the next step, and then something worse happens that sets him back two steps. And he says, I'm paraphrasing this, but he says, it's not the despair. I can deal with the despair. It's the hope. And I think that kind of sums it up. It's just the hope is the thing that keeps on destroying him.
Uh-oh. We're getting into another traffic jam, and we're going to be late for the kind people meeting us at the Mark Twain House if we don't.
It's not the despair, Kurt. It's
get out
the
of
hope.
This. It is the hope, and I was hoping there for a minute. And in a minute, we're going to hear from some great musicians about their life hauling from town to town. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're driving along the road in Connecticut. Actually, Andy Borowitz is driving. This is Studio 360's Road Show. On our way from New York City to Hartford to see Mark Twain's house. Stay with us. in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, the four-wheeled rolling down the highway version. I'm with Andy Borowitz, the writer and humorist who is driving and so certainly gets to control the tape deck. You've put in the White Stripes CD. This is not their big hit.
No, this isn't. This is the last song on the CD. It's true that we love each other, one another. It's it's just such a fun album because it's... You can just tell that he's having a lot of fun. They're both having a lot of fun making this album. Meg White is not going to make anybody, forget about, I don't know who the great drummers of all time are. Gene Krupa, I don't know.
Ginger Baker.
Yeah, Ginger Baker, of course. But she, she bangs it out. And he's got a phenomenal voice and just I just pretty much love everything he does.
Well, we're about to listen to two touring musicians, one who has been at it for years and years, and another who has just gotten started. First, Ralph Stanley. Do you know who Ralph Stanley is?
I do not. Tell me.
He is the bluegrass legend who became famous on the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Okay, now I know. And boy, did I feel bad after you said the word legend. I didn't know who he was. Don't talk about making me feel stupid. But no, I do. I love that movie.
Well, he told us about his 55 years of touring on the road and what it was like at the very beginning when he was one of the Stanley Brothers.
When we first started, all we had to travel in was a car. And maybe there'd be five people in the car, and then we didn't have any place to put our instruments. Most of the time we tied the bass fiddle on the top, but when we didn't, after you put about five instruments and the bass on top of you all in the car, well, it got pretty tiresome. And then there was lots of times that we didn't have time, to really stop and eat a meal. We just had to grab us a bologna sandwich or a can of Vienna sausage or whatever we could get. Now, the bluegrass festivals are hard because you usually have to get there early of a day and do an afternoon show and then also a night show. And then, the time that you spend there sometimes, maybe 12 hours. And that gets a little tiresome, but I have a bus and I have a bed to go to when I want to and rest, so I make it okay. Time I get through with the tour, I'm ready to go home and stay three or four days at home. I'm always ready to go again, so it makes it pretty nice. I guess the worst thing about the road is when you have when you play a show like here tonight and have 800 miles to travel for the next show tomorrow night. So that gets sort of worse.
That's bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, whose voice you may know from the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and whose pronunciation, Andy, of Vienna sausage, I really love. And just the idea of subsisting on cans of Vienna sausage on the road is one more reason why I personally could not live the life longer than this one afternoon that we're doing on the road. Sushila Raman is a musician you probably don't know yet. She sings a hybrid of South Indian classical music and Western pop, and she's just completed her first European tour. 3 concerts a week, 150 in the last year. She's about to try her luck here in this country, and we asked her if her new professional life on the road has surprised her and what she's expecting of our America.
I once went to Russia on tour, and I did a very, very good gig in Moscow, and then I had to do a second gig, which was in a club full of gangsters. You know, at one point, you know, there were people were talking, you know, which is quite unusual for my concerts. And at one point, we asked the sound engineer, "Oh well, could you tell the people to be quiet?" And they said, "Oh no, they'll pull guns on me." So I wouldn't want to go back to that kind of club again, I guess. Ye mera divana. I feel great excitement at the thought of coming to New York and coming to America. I think obviously the mythology of being on the road in the US is a strong... I have a strong sense of it from films like The Blues Brothers and, you know, I mean, it's a strong part of the consciousness. You know, I think it's a crazy place where, you know, the unexpected can happen. I've driven along the West Coast. I've driven from San Francisco to Seattle. And, you know, I know America is such a vast, beautiful country with incredible landscapes. And I think that is going to be a great plus, just looking out of the window.
Sushila Raman is touring the United States this summer, and her new CD is called Love Trap. Trey Kay produced those stories. Love Trap is a good name for an album.
Sure is.
It was wonderful to hear her and her lovely British Indian voice talk about her version of the American road myth, which involves the Blues Brothers. I guess she's younger.
I guess so. Although, you know what? Now I remember it. I actually saw the Blues Brothers in Texas on that first road trip I took out to California.
Really?
Yeah. Coincidence.
Ralph Stanley, who we also heard, as I said, is famous from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Well, you know, in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, you know, now that you bring it up, reminds me, we were discussing what the great road pictures are, and I guess you'd probably put Sullivan's Travels in there,
absolutely,
too.
Although, I recently watched Sullivan's Travels, which is, of course, the Preston Sturges movie.
Were you disappointed in the second half of it?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's a downer, isn't it?
It is a downer. And that the scene of all the people laughing at the end at the movie when he realizes that he should just keep making comedies,
right,
is a little scary, actually. To
right.
Me.
But, you know, the thing about Sullivan's Travels, I think, you know, he demonstrates very vividly how much more we enjoy comedy by making a second half of a movie that's such a drag. But I'm sure he did it intentionally, but it's an amazing...
You think he did do that?
I do think. Or unconsciously. But it's sure a great demonstration of the value of comedy. You know, as we head towards Mark Twain's house, reminds us of just how much, you know, how much comedy really is serious in its own way. It can just sort of communicate in a way without people feeling like they're being forced to take bad medicine.
Twain, among his other enduring achievements, really did sort of set up the archetype, the template for various kinds of road stories. I mean, obviously Huckleberry Finn, but Roughing It, which are his tales of nonfiction-ish tales of being out in the West when he was a young man, and Life in the Mississippi and Innocence Abroad. He really, this was a real recurring theme for him.
I think he saw just tremendous possibilities. I think he was a very restless guy in a way. And I think you'll see that even in his biography, he never seemed to be satisfied with just doing one thing, which is why he kept on sort of stretching. And for a while, it worked so well for him because he kept on expanding into new kinds of writing and performing. He was a wonderful speaker. But I think eventually, like, you know, a lot of people who reach far, he kind of overreached and got into some things he probably shouldn't have.
As a creative artist?
No, I think just as an entrepreneur, he considered himself a great businessman and an innovator. And I think a friend of mine just told me, because I was talking about this visit I was going to make, and he said that he was actually offered the opportunity to invest in the telephone, which I didn't realize. And Twain's response to that was, only lawyers are going to use that.
Well, he had it half right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But now is he, you know, if he only could walk through the, you know, the Sherman Oaks Galleria and see all the 13-year-old girls on cell phones telling them where they are at that precise location, he'd see that he was kind of wrong. So where are we going once we're...
Exit 46, Mark Twain House. And I think across
Harriet
the
Beecher
street,
Stowe House.
Harriet Beecher Stowe House. Oh, now we're getting to the mansion, the old 19th century giant pile of stone mansions.
That's Harriet Beecher Stowe's house. I just saw Stowe.
Well, then.
This must be.
This must be. Yeah, Mark Twain House. I think we can. It's raining a little bit, but we can survive without. Rain gear, should we go? We're here just as the Twain House is closing, but if we get up that stairway quickly, we can get in and look around. Thanks. Hi, I'm Kurt.
Hi, Kurt.
This is Andy Borowitz.
Hi, Annie. Nice to meet you.
What we're going to do is bring you upstairs to our curatorial area.
Great.
Where we have some of the items on display. And this is Chris Barnett, director of our education area.
Hi. Thanks for having us and staying late.
Certainly. Twain was a great reader, even though he was not well educated. One of his favorite books was The Lives of Plutarch. This is his volume of Plutarch's Lives. But if you notice that he annotates everything, as you're looking at here, Plutarch's Lives of Illustrious Men. And then he writes in rotten English, translated from the Greek, the whole carefully revised and corrected by a jackass.
I mean, and who is this? This was just for his own amusement. This
just
was
for his own
really
amusement. You know, he's not publishing this stuff. Also, as you go through his volumes and so forth, he regularly edits the writing. He's tossing out adjectives here and there. He doesn't like that. He also edits them out and so forth like that.
Right.
This is what's called the memory jogger. It is actually a marble slate that he could write on, and then he could erase. As you notice, that there's a pencil attached with a string to it. So again, this is your palm pilot in Twain's time. And on here are various notations that he has. It might be things that he's traveling along. He sees something interesting. He hears an interesting turn of phrase. He makes a note of it. This is Twain's original writing that's still on the memory jogger. And here, obviously, Twain is in the process of getting ready to leave, probably on one of his lectures. As he's got written here, leave the cat behind, take along the whiskey. Cats were the favorite pet of the family. During the years they lived here, they had over 15 cats in this house. Sam always named the cats. He would name them things like Satan and Sin and Sour Mash, Perdition, such as that. And the reason that Sam said he liked to name the cats that is he got a real kick out of the girls calling the cats in at night. Because here lived in this very exclusive neighborhood with Harriet Beecher Stowe, a great religious lady across the road, and these young girls were out there saying, Satan, time to come home. Sin, come back.
And I guess I should say, since we haven't said it yet in the show, that of course Mark Twain's real name was Samuel Clemens.
Samuel Clemens, right. Twain's favorite game in life was billiards. Wasn't when he wasn't smoking and drinking, but although he was able to combine all those interests all at once. Twain used this as his writing area. This is where he writes Huckleberry Finn. This is where he writes Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, Life on the Mississippi, Prince and the Pauper. This is the place that actually the writing takes place.
Amazing.
So this is the magical room.
And there's a porch, obviously, where he...
There are actually several porches. There's a porch here, there's a second porch here, there's a third porch off to the side. So it was a very airy space for him to work in, which was necessary. Again, he was a chain cigar smoker, smoked upwards to 20 cigars a day. And this was more or less his private area. did not allow any of the servants to come into this room to clean this room, so you can imagine it must have been really a kind of a nasty place to be in for the most part. He was also a very messy writer. His desk, his writing desk, was actually pushed up against that wall into the corner down at the far end of the room. He faced the wall when he wrote because he said that he was easily distracted and he was a naturally lazy man, and any distractions would take him away from his work. So he'd sit there staring at the wall, writing, throwing papers around. People who came found the floors were simply covered with wadded up pieces of paper, cigar butts all over the place. And he would use the billiards table as his research table. He would lay out the books there. At the same time, he would lay out his manuscripts. That was where he would kind of organize and outline his works. We'll go on down the stairs here, down to the second floor.
He was a guy into high technology.
He loved new technology, and the house is full of new technology. The house, built in 1874, had running water throughout the house, flush toilets, baths, showers. Central heat was included in the house. One of the first private telephones in Hartford was installed here in the house. At the same time, he invests very heavily in new inventions. He invents some things himself. He invents what he calls a self-pasting notebook. Or scrapbook, because he says one of the things that frustrated the most was trying to glue, you know, paper clippings into a book. So basically he developed his own self-pasting book, and actually it sold fairly well. At the same time, some of his investments go very wrong. The Page Compositor, which is downstairs, which was designed to be a mechanical typesetter, and ultimately will help to drive him into bankruptcy in 1891, when he actually is forced to leave the Hartford house here to go again on a world lecture tour to pay back all of his debtors and to
So that's what really that. It was finances that drove him out of this house?
Yes.
But you know, it's interesting when you think what he did to keep this all going was he went on the road again, much like Willie Nelson with the IRS.
Yes. On the road again, yes.
It's the same thing. It's when you're a performer.
And he actually does pay off all of his debtors and makes a second fortune on top of that. So when he dies, he's a wealthy man.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Take care. All right. Here we go.
Bye, Hartford.
Thanks for joining us all on Studio 360. Andy Borowitz, of course, is the author of Who Moved My Soap? The CEO's Guide to Surviving in Prison. And you can read his fresh humor every day, every weekday?
Every weekday.
On BorowitzReport.com. And you can find out more about him and all the other stories you heard today at Studio360.org.
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Ave Carrillo,
Michelle Siegel,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Noble,
Trent Wolbe,
Andy Lancet.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by donors to PRI's Producers Forum, who include Dr. Claire Gaudiani and Christopher and Elizabeth Sullivan. Additional support is provided by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, accelerating entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org, and by audible.com, where you can download audio of this show and other public radio programs, as well as best-selling books and the New York Times. All at audible.com/studio360.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360,
dancers have a peculiar and sometimes troubling relationship to their bodies.
The power of the naked body in art.
The body is this incredible spiritual vessel that is at once an amazing metaphor.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me and the choreographer Bill T. Jones next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
Next time in Studio 360.
The body is this incredible spiritual vessel that is at once an amazing metaphor.
The choreographer Bill T. Jones, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.